Over the last year, I've had one of the great adventures of my lifetime. I've traveled throughout the Colorado River system with my tape recorder and recorded conversations with dozens of folks. Indians, ranchers, farmers, scientists, historians, lawyers, politicians, dam builders, whitewater boat women, environmentalists, artists, and writers. And also those key administrators known as water buffaloes who now determine the dispersal of the waters to the irrigation districts and municipalities both inside and outside the watershed. What a privilege it's been for me to listen to so many diverse points of view from people for whom the Colorado River is vital and real. People who realize that when you turn open a faucet in Los Angeles or Phoenix, a lot of the water that's coming out has been pumped hundreds of miles from the Colorado River. I've only recently realized that if I fill a glass of water in Los Angeles or San Diego, or Phoenix, Denver, Provo, or Albuquerque, it's probable that over half the water in that glass comes from the Colorado River system. It's a small river, but without it, many of the cities of the West and most of the irrigation districts would never have developed. The Colorado River provides water for 25 million of us throughout the West. Just think of that. In the last century, waters from the Colorado River and its tributaries have been dammed and redirected to meet the needs of folks from seven western states and northwestern Mexico. My name is Jack Leffler, and I'd like to invite you to join me in the six-part radio series that follows, where we explore moving waters, the Colorado River, and the West. Hiking the ancient trails of the Colorado Plateau, one can stumble onto artifacts created by people from cultures that have long since disappeared. Human beings have inhabited the North American continent for at least 12,000 years. It's interesting that just about every culture or civilization envisions an environment appropriate for its respective creation myth, whether it's the Garden of Eden or the Grand Canyon. One snowy day last winter, I met with Vernon Masayasva on the outskirts of Flagstaff. Vernon is a Hopi Indian from New Araibi. He used to be the chairman of the Hopi Tribal Council, and before that was an educator for his people. Vernon shared part of the mythic history of the Hopis, whose homeland lies atop Black Mesa in northern Arizona.
There's a point east of the Big Colorado, on the banks of Little Colorado River, a very sacred site we call Sibabwini, which is our emergence. It's our umbilical cord that connects us to our motherland. And we came up to the top. The elders apparently figured this is where we're going to stay. Those days, people were different and they had a very close connection with the Creator. They discovered that a person was already living there because they found foot tracks. They finally found a man, Masa, working his field. And they approached Masa. Is this your land? No, it's not my land, but I take care of it. Then the question, can we stay here with you? And Masa said, that's not up to me. That's up to you people. And he told them to look around. What do you see? It's barren land. So it's a hard place to settle. It's poor and yet it's rich. So if you decide to stay, that would be your decision. So they finally agreed that they would stay. Masa says, well, then you have to help me steward this land. And they agreed to a covenant. So we decided that we would live with Masa, help steward the land, live according to his law.
Gary Paul Nabhan is an ethnobotanist, writer, and adventurer whose fascination with the Colorado River watershed continues to endure even after over 30 years of field research. Together, Gary and I have run the San Juan River in southern Utah and wandered the backcountry of Mexico, where the Sonoran Desert meets the Sea of Cortez. Gary Nabhan is a champion of those indigenous peoples who continue to seek their tribal destinies within their home habitats.
Robert Forbes, who was the first dean of the School of Agriculture at University of Arizona, took a trip down the Colorado several times in the 1890s and early 1900s from where Fort Mojave is today, or that community is today, down to the Delta. And we had this remarkable landscape of what I might call watershed agriculture, floodwater recession agriculture, where people would wait to plant their summer crops after the spring snowmelt increased the flows in the Colorado. And they would go out onto the floodplains, muddy bottoms, sometimes tossing seeds out of their mouth, as well as hand broadcasting panic grass and other crops unique to the Colorado River system, as well as other ones that had been exchanged over the millennia with Mexican Indian farmers. And that agriculture was uniquely adapted to the Colorado River watershed's heat, salinity, soil fertility, growing season length, and was absolutely unique in terms of anything else in North America. And by the mid-teens, 1910 to 1918, we'd really lost that system. Aldo Leopold and his brother Carl, when they canoed down the Delta, really saw the remnants of that system. The Kokopé Indian agriculture was already gone and growing back in native and exotic plants, but that wonderful mosaic that showed the health of cultural landscapes and natural landscapes interplaying with one another was already lost by the time Aldo Leopold canoed on the Delta.
Patty Limerick is a well-known historian, author, and co-founder of the Center of the American West at the University of Colorado in Boulder. Patty's droll humor embellishes her description of the mindset of many Eastern Americans when they first entered the arid West of the 19th century.
This looked abnormal, deviant, unacceptable, flawed. The language that some people use in the 19th century, it's almost God's error that he didn't do this right. Expect a creator who did such a good job on other areas would be able to carry through. And so then some of the irrigation promoters developed the quite wonderful interpretation that this is sort of like a final exam given to humanity, that God's not going to do all the work for you, so you have to take this unfinished project and get the water dammed, kept from dispersing in the spring and early summer, and hold it there so you can green it up. To go through the first round of horror, which I think a lot of people did on the Overland Trail, of saying this is the ugliest wasteland, why would God give us this, to then get to this next level of cognition of saying, oh, it's a challenge, I get it, it's put these parts together and then you'll have Ohio.
Folklorist Hal Cannon is the founding director of the Western Folklife Center in Elko, Nevada. A Utah native, Hal is directly descended from the great Mormon pioneer Brigham Young, whose followers first settled the area east of the Great Salt Lake.
I grew up with, of course, the story of Jim Bridger telling the Mormons that he'd give $1,000 for the first bushel of corn that was grown in these valleys coming out of the Wasatch Mountains. And the Mormons were always proud of all the bushels of corn that they grew out of the wilderness. And I remember my dad getting up in the middle of the night to take his turn in irrigation, and just how beautifully organized the irrigation district was, and how really the power of the community had a lot to do with your place on the line of irrigation. And oftentimes the most powerful person in an agricultural community was the water master in Mormon communities. And that's still the case today. And lives, as you know, have been lost over water. People taking more than their turn, taking more than their share. People taking advantage of high ority rather than the fairness of their equal share of water. So I guess I see the power of it on a very small basis. Men out with a plow or a digger or shovels and a pick and making the water go where they wanted it to go. I mean, to me, that's the saga of the pioneering experience, not the Corps of Engineers.
Imagining a mental map, the headwaters of the Green River spring from glaciers in the Wind River Mountains of Wyoming. Further south, the Green River joins the Colorado near Moab, Utah. I met Charlie Love, who's a professor at Western Wyoming Community College in Rock Springs. Charlie gives us a geology lesson.
The reason that those rivers head from that country is due to two kinds of geologic past, one more remote than the other. And that is the building of the Rocky Mountains in what we call the Laramide Orogeny about 70 million years ago down to about 40 million years ago. The other is the intrusion of Yellowstone National Park. It is, and I call it an intrusion, because some magnificent hot body of rock down below, the continent has been pushed over, and like a blowtorch, it has burned a hole through the continent, and in recent geologic time, the last 2 million years, has exploded 3 times. practically on schedule. And this may be one of the reasons the Green River flows the direction that it does.
To continue with our mental map, the Colorado River flows southwestward through Colorado into southeastern Utah, where it's joined by the Green River. The Colorado then flows into Arizona, where it heads south and separates Arizona from Nevada and California. It then enters Mexico and finally reaches the delta at the north end of the Sea of Cortez. Traditionally, during the spring, the river flooded, burying the floodplains beneath a relentless torrent. In the dry season, the river slowed to a relative trickle. Before construction of the great dams in the 20th century, agriculturalists transplanted from the east envisioned farming the floodplains and irrigating their fields by running water in ditches from the river. But first, they had to control the flow of the river. I spoke with William DeBuis, author of Salt Dreams, who told me about the extraordinary debacle that resulted in the Salton Sea.
Essentially, the California Development Company, in the process of developing the burning desert that they rechristened Imperial Valley, had been having a hell of a lot of trouble getting water to the valley because in the cheap and hurried way they built their main irrigation canal that would bring water from the Colorado River to the Salton Sink. That first effort at building the canal kept silting up. And so especially when the water was low, as it was in the winter, which was the most crucial growing time in that desert, they couldn't get enough water down the canal, actually, to get to the valley. As an expedient, they simply made a shortcut between a bend of the canal and the Colorado River and just dug an open ditch between those two. And they put no headgate in that they could close to shut the flow of water off if they ever had to. They thought, well, we've got time because the Colorado River won't flood in the wintertime. Well, sure enough, it flooded in the wintertime and just burst through this open gap. And at that time, geologically, the Colorado, having oscillated back and forth its delta, had been over on the east side of the delta for a long time, and geologically it was time for it to start moving west. Well, here was the great opportunity, an open door, a heavy flow of water, and boom, it went, and essentially the river adopted the irrigation canal as its main channel. And what then ensued was a kind of apocalyptic experience for the Imperial Valley as the river flooded and flooded and flooded with repeated storms. And it followed in the spring again with snowmelt. And for 2 years, a kind of Humpty Dumpty story was played out with all the king's horses and all the king's men trying to put the river back again. And they couldn't do it for 2 years until finally, with all the resources of the Southern Pacific Railroad put at the disposal of a really crack team of engineers, the gap was finally closed and the river was constrained within its old channel. In the aftermath of this, there was the Salton Sea created with all this 2 years of the greater part of the flow of the Colorado River going into the Salton Sink. And really, there was also a new way of thinking about what people in the United States wanted to do about the Colorado River. In a sense, the reverberations of that great flood that filled the Salton Sink shook their way into the creation of the hydraulic society that we have down there today. They led, in a sense, directly, although there were other strains joining this line, but they led to the construction of Boulder, now Hoover Dam, and they led to the California Aqueduct, and they led to the All-American Canal. They led to the plumbing of the Colorado River.
It had become apparent to agriculturalists, developers, politicians, and others that the Colorado River was indeed the aquatic lifeline of the American Southwest. Early on, Southern Californians recognized that these river waters were valuable not only to farmers, but also to coastal cities, including Los Angeles and San Diego. It was obvious that the precious waters of the Colorado River would have to be apportioned. I met with attorney William Swan, who was a Colorado River scholar. Bill talked about the historic meeting held in Santa Fe, presided over by Secretary of Commerce Herbert Hoover, that led to the 1922 Colorado River Compact and the Law of the River.
Congress was appropriating money for diversion works clear back in the 1800s. But when things really got rolling in the late 1800s, early 1900s, there was just simply a huge tension because as the West began to develop, you had the populations developing more in the Southwest in California and along the river in Arizona, and not so much in the other states. And the other states, looking at this interstate river, said, whoa, wait a minute, we may be at risk here because under the doctrine of prior appropriation, somebody who puts the water to use could claim the whole right to the river, and so they could eventually claim possibly all of the river flow for themselves. So they got very nervous about that, the upper basin states, and decided to go to Congress and ask Congress to help with the development of a compact. So Congress consented. They appointed a referee, so to speak, in the form of Mr. Hoover. They sat down and tried to work out a compact. They would like, I think, to have worked out a situation where they could figure out how much each state would get, but that was just too difficult. So they divided it into basins, the upper basin states of Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, against the three lower basin states of Arizona, California, and Nevada, and tried to work out a division of the water just to protect each sphere, so to speak, the upper sphere and the lower sphere. And they finally did that by thinking that the river flowed more than 15 million acre feet a year and divided it 50-50, 7.5 per year to the upper basin, 7.5 to the lower basin, as some way of sharing the river in perpetuity so that the upper basin would feel secure. In hindsight, it's flawed because the river may not produce that much water, and they recognized at the time that Mexico would eventually need a share of that. And of course, later in the 1940s, we did work out the treaty with Mexico, which gave Mexico a guaranteed 1.5 million. When you add those up, 7.5, 7.5, and the 1.5, you're at 16.5 million acre feet. And even the Bureau of Reclamation will say the river doesn't produce that every year. And it's probably close to 15 million acre feet, but it's not 16.5. So we'll have a crisis someday in the future. So that division under the Compact of 1922 is really the foundation of this whole thing.
Former Arizona Congressman and Secretary of the Interior Stuart Udall contends that the Santa Fe Colorado River Compact led to events that enabled Californians to develop Colorado River water well in advance of the other six states.
Herbert Hoover served them well. I've never understood why he was there. He was, in effect, California's agent in putting this through. They wanted an agreement that would enable them to go to Congress and build Boulder Dam. That was a kind of forced marriage. It ended up with this strange thing that never happened in other basins, of each state being allocated a certain amount of water. This was purely arbitrary. There was no rational basis for it. Hoover, I'm sure, exerted pressure. They had to have an agreement. That led, of course, to the construction of Boulder Dam. And that enormous project went forward in the depths of the Great Depression. This again showed the political power that Southern California was exerting and the economic power, because it got the electric power companies involved. And this was, in essence, a California project. It wasn't anything beneficial to the basin, and the water, other than that flowing down the river to the delta and flowing to the few irrigation districts like Imperial, huge users of water, the key water, rather good quality water, was going to Southern California through an aqueduct.
In Santa Barbara, I met with Norris Hundley, author of The Great Thirst and lifelong Colorado River scholar, who spoke of other inadequacies of the 1922 Compact.
The other thing to keep in mind about the Compact is that it reflects its time in being an ethnocentric document. The Indians weren't invited to participate, nor was there any consideration of giving them a share of the water. Hoover said, we don't want to put a quote-unquote wild Indian provision in here, create a problem for ourselves. Mexico asked to have representation. Prior to this time, and would go on for another two decades, Mexico had been negotiating with the United States over rights to Colorado River water and to water of the Rio Grande. The compact negotiators said no to inviting Mexicans. We don't want to have the Mexicans here. Everyone suspected there would someday be a treaty. The basins would share that Mexican burden, as they called it. But other than that, nothing was said.
Floyd Dominey served as commissioner of the Bureau of Reclamation during the Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson administrations. This was a major period of dam building west of the 100th Meridian, that dividing line that separates the verdant eastern United States from the arid west. Many Western Americans still share the mindset that nature had left the arid West bereft of water, and that it was up to human ingenuity to repair this flaw. I visited Floyd Dominey on his farm in Virginia, where he spoke of his reasoning for construction of the most contested dam in America, the Glen Canyon Dam.
Well, you've got to recognize that the law of the river puts the upper basin in a straitjacket. They can't develop their share of the water unless they have control of the river to equalize the flow from wet to dry years, because the law requires them to deliver 7.5 million acre feet a year, or at least 75 million acre feet over 10-year moving average. Now, that can't possibly be done and still leave any water for their development unless they have a huge sponge somewhere just above the point you measure, so that you can capture the 30 million acre foot years to balance the 6 million acre foot years. And you never know when that 6 million acre foot's going to come, and you don't know, you may have 5 or 6 years in a row with less than 7.5 million acre feet of water in the entire year in the Colorado. So this is why Glen Canyon is necessary. It had to be located just as close to Lee's Ferry as possible, so you could capture the San Juan and the Escalante and the Green and all the rest of them. For example, the city of Albuquerque couldn't depend on its 110,000 acre feet of water out of the San Juan River diverted through the Chama unless it had the storage capacity in Glen Canyon Dam. The water wouldn't be there in many years without Glen Canyon Dam. And all the diversions in Colorado and Utah and Wyoming, the same thing is true. A Glen Canyon Dam is absolutely essential to provide that steady flow of water from the good to the bad years.
Early on, Arizona and California competed for waters of the Colorado River, a situation that led to what many regard as the greatest water war in the history of the West. In 1963, the Supreme Court awarded Arizona its annual apportionment of 2.8 million acre feet as compared with California's 4.4 million acre feet. However, it was determined that Arizona's apportionment was junior to California's. In other words, during an extended drought, Arizona would have to relinquish a vast proportion of its annual allocation of Colorado River water to California, should there not be enough water to go around. In Las Vegas, Nevada, I met with Patricia Mulroy, who is the general manager of the Southern Nevada Water Authority and one of the most highly regarded of the so-called water buffaloes who manage the waters of the Colorado River.
The state of California probably is the furthest along in looking at water as a commodity. The state of Arizona still has much more of a resource perspective and blocks against any commodity perspective on water. There is a much closer relationship within the state of Arizona of the people themselves to the water supply. They don't have a longer-term sense of it in the state of California. And they're developing along very different lines. Finding bridges there is going to be a real challenge. This is the year 2001, and I can appreciate why, when the compacts and the lower basin arrangements and Arizona versus California, why all the things happened that did, that led to the state of California claiming a priority water right over the state of Arizona. But step back, this is 2001. Why would a group of cities in California have the right to run water down the streets while the cities in the state of Arizona go dry? That makes no sense. That priority is antiquated. It may have had usefulness between competing economic interests and the agricultural level, but it is preposterous today between cities. So how are you ever going to find common ground in the lower basin when one state bears the benefit of something happening and the other bears only the consequences? There's a disconnect there. There have to be mutual benefits and mutual consequences. And I've long become convinced that unless that cultural view that one state trumping another state, saying I have something you don't have, goes away, the problems in the lower basin of the Colorado River are going to become insurmountable.
These problems include not only the overallocation of the Colorado River, which serves a growing human population of over 30 million, all of us connected to each other by the presence of the river, but King Solomon concerns, such as the resolution of prior Indian water rights, the enormous salinity in the Colorado River, pollution from pesticides and nuclear waste, agriculture competing with urbanization and industry, massive evaporation from giant reservoirs, the fact that almost no water now flows from the Colorado River into the delta at the Sea of Cortez, and the effect of the introduction of both the National Environmental Policy Act and the Endangered Species Act on future development within the Colorado River Basin and beyond. And now some sound thinking for every one of us who lives on the reservations, ranches, and farms in towns and cities who rely on the Colorado River, from friend, poet, and philosopher Gary Snyder.
Watersheds are obvious concepts to think in terms of. They have unarguable boundaries, and they're easy to map. They're a very clear entity in the phenomenal world. A lot of watershed thinking is very professional, scientific, organized and led by government agencies in many cases, and the territory of hydrologists and GIS mappers, soil scientists, fisheries people, and so forth. But there is another side that actually goes back several decades, which is the community watershed consciousness, where people became engaged with their watershed regions as part of re-inhabitation, of becoming members of a place, a part of a decision to become a people who live somewhere and who takes responsibility for a place as members of that community. And that is the cultural side of what we call bioregionalism. And that has brought about watershed groups and watershed consciousness, which is not simply measuring the rate of flow or testing pollution, but is writing poems, is painting pictures, taking photographs, telling tales, watershed art, and watershed celebrations, like Lewis McAdams and his Friends of the Los Angeles River, started before anything else with a river celebration for the LA River. Everybody thought they were nuts. Celebrate that old ditch? Lewis said, we got to start somewhere. Let's do a dance and read poems to cheer it up. That's actually how it started, to cheer the river up. If one is a professional, you're thinking about it like E.O. Wilson thinks about life in a way. If you're a community member, all of the qualities of the region, including its beauty and its integrity, are part of what concern you. And you don't measure the watershed simply in nuts and bolts terms of biological diversity and soil quality or water purity, but in something that is subtler and deeper, which is how does it feel and how is life doing here? How are things all getting along with each other? What kind of a dance is this? How is the song going? How is the music rising from it? How do we feel when we walk the ridge or go down the river? Insights and feelings that come out of that are expressed in the arts. They're also expressed in architecture. They're expressed in the designs you put on your shirt, in the kinds of sandals you wear. They enter in ways that we can't even quite trace. They enter into the life of a place, of a people who live in a place. That's true.
Moving Waters, the Colorado River in the West, is a production of the Arizona Humanities Council. Executive Director Dan Schilling. Our series is sponsored by the Humanities Councils and Endowments of Arizona, California, Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming. Funding was provided by the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Ford Foundation. The project director is Nancy Dowlett. The executive producer is Marcos Martinez. Our production assistant is Celestia Peregrina Leffler. The series was produced in its entirety by Jack Leffler in Santa Fe, New Mexico. For Moving Waters, the Colorado River in the West, thank you for listening.